Well, I did say that this term you're coming to my world, the world of Midrash. And it is a very big, wide, challenging, and in my view a fascinating world. Before we launch, let me say what Midrash is, because maybe we're not sure. Yeah, I mean, rabbi quotes Midrash, but what is Midrash per se? Stories? It contains stories. Traditions? It contains traditions. But essentially, Midrash is Bible interpretation. It's the oldest known form of interpreting the Bible. It goes back to hoary antiquity. We don't know how far back. In fact, it may go back to the biblical period itself. But when we talk about Bible interpretation, we have to get clear in our minds that there's more than one kind of interpretation. Rashi, Ibn Ezra, the great scholars of the Middle Ages, were passionately involved in the pursuit of plain meaning. That was their task. Plain meaning, pshat. What is the plain meaning of the biblical text? What do the Hebrew words mean? And I'll tell you, Sylvia, that this pursuit of pshat began in Iraq, Baghdad. And it was occasioned, no doubt, by the Arabs.
The Arabs?
Yes, because they would say to the rabbinic scholars, our scripture, the Quran, is Arabic, is well known, and it is clear everywhere. You have a text, you don't even know what it means. Hebrew is already for you a semi-dead language. And this drove Saadia Gaon and others to say, what are you talking about? And they began to analyze Hebrew, analyze its meaning, and in so doing, began to analyze the plain meaning of the text.
But then this was late, 7th
century. This is 9th century.
Yeah.
But for generations and centuries before that, the rabbis knew the plain meaning. They had a jolly good idea what the plain meaning of the Hebrew language was. How do I know? They produced Aramaic translations of the Bible. Can't do that unless you know what the words mean. They were using Hebrew. The language of the Mishnah is Hebrew. The language of our ancient commentaries is Hebrew. They were fluent in Hebrew. But when they studied Bible, they were not interested in searching for plain meaning. For them, the Bible was the living and eternal word of the living and eternal God. And our job is to find meanings and messages for our generation and future generations in that living and eternal word. Our task is to decode the text, to make the text speak to future generations.
Is that different from the plain meaning?
Oh, very much so. Because plain meaning is, this is what the word means. The rabbis will say, well, no, this has subtle additional meanings to teach us something else. You'll see how it works. We'll illustrate it pretty fully before we're finished. And so, the Midrashic interpretation is subjective. I'm looking in the text for a meaning. I'm not getting the meaning out of the text, I'm reading a meaning into the text. But they were desperate to do this, because the age of the rabbis was a period, the first 5 centuries of the current era, were, as you know, a period of great tragedy. The loss of the temple, accompanied by a considerable loss of life, collapse of the Bar Kokhba uprising, accompanied by a holocaust, the rise of Christianity to predominance, we've said this before, ushered in that long night of oppression and suppression of the Jewish people. So the rabbis were living in an age where they were desperate to communicate messages to future generations, and Midrash was the medium through which they did this. So you have to appreciate that Midrash was a living organism. We today have Midrashic literature. What we tend to overlook is the literature was made up of living sermons given to live audiences in the land of Israel in the 5 centuries of the current era. Now, I want to illustrate all of this by taking a story which you are all familiar with. It's an iconic story which sits at the very heart of rabbinic ideology, and that's the story of the binding of Isaac. We read it twice every year, once as Parashat Vayera, and of course on Rosh Hashanah. It is an integral part of our reading. The story in itself is sufficiently disturbing, that God asks Abraham to sacrifice Isaac. Or I say he didn't mean it. I don't care whether he meant it or not. The very fact that he said it, you know, don't say such things. So the story in its own right is very disturbing and very dramatic. But the rabbis will turn it into something beyond imagination. They will rewrite the biblical script and take the Akedah and turn it into an inspiration for generations of suffering. So let's begin by taking a look at the story itself. That's why I've given you this text first. Yeah. You'll get the Midrash later. Vayi achar devarim ha'eleh. Came to pass after these words, these things. And the very question that we have to ask the rabbis are, what words, what things? What was the prequel to this story? Well, if I look in the Bible, it's very simple. According to the Torah, immediately prior to this event, Abraham was engaged in an altercation with a local Canaanite king, Avimelech, over an all-important entity, water rights. Now, in the Middle East, water rights are not something to be left to chance. These are here are my watering holes, and you took them. And therefore, Abraham has to establish his ownership and procure a binding oath from Avimelech that these are my water rights, and he makes him swear an oath, and so the place becomes known as Be'er Sheva. So this is not a simple story, this is quite an event. And after these things, God, God tested Abraham. And that, of course, is the biggest problem of all. When you test somebody, what are you trying to do? You're trying to find out about them. I want to find out what you know. I want to find out what you're capable of. But why should the all-knowing, all-seeing God have to test anybody? He's supposed to be able to read the thoughts and hearts of man. So how is it he's making tests? That implies he doesn't know everything. Fair point? And if you say he does know everything, so why is he making a poor old man of 100 plus jump around like this? Leave him alone. After all, he left his land. I told him, go. He goes. Told him to circumcise. Circumcise himself. Whatever he told him to do, he did. By now, Abraham should have established his credentials of faith beyond any question or doubt. And then suddenly God tests him.
In testing him, it's laying down a marker for future generations. This is a change in the way that sacrifices are made, in the way that one behaves.
So you think that the purpose of the Akedah was to discourage people from sacrificing their children?
Yes.
That's a fair point, but Abraham had never entertained such ideas in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
For him, nothing could have been more horrific than human sacrifice. So add to the fact he's got to make that sacrifice on his own son, so he's horror within horror.
All right, but that strengthens my point rather than weakens it.
Yes, but yeah. I'm not dispensing with your point, that I want to demonstrate to future generations, don't do this. But he could just as easily have said, don't do it. I mean, in the Torah, he says a lot of things that we don't do and we ignore. But he could have put it there.
Sure.
When he says to him, Abraham, he says, here am I. I'm always delighted by this, because I would have thought the voice comes thundering out of heaven, and Abraham would fall. It's the bottom of the right-hand side of the page, chapter 22. And Abraham would fall flat on his face and say, Lord, your servant hears you speak. I always compare this to a husband and wife. You know, the wife is in the kitchen and she calls out, Avraham, and he says, I'm here. It's so informal that it indicates something of the intimate nature between God and his chosen one. Vayomer, and he says, Kachna et binecha et yechidecha asher ahavta. Now, kachna means take. Na is normally interpreted by the rabbis to mean please. In modern Hebrew, na lo le'asher. But in reality, as Ibn Ezra points out, it has the same meaning as in Arabic now. But Ibn Ezra was, of course, the pursuer of plain meaning, and he knew Arabic was his mother tongue. So, kachna, take now. Now, not next week. Now. It's like paying your fines. Take your son, your only one whom you love, et Yitzchak, Isaac, v'lech lecha el eretz ha-Moriah, and go to the land of Moriah, v'alehu sham le'ola, and offer him up as a burnt offering, al achar ha'arim, upon one of the mountains, asher o'ma elecha, which I will tell you. Terrific statement.
Excuse me, why does he emphasize Yechidicha?
Now, this is the whole point. This is part of the horror of it. He's going to ask Abraham to take his beloved son that Abraham doesn't know. That's it. Why is he sticking the knife in and twisting it?
That's right.
Take your son, your only one whom you love. That's what I call rubbing his nose in it.
But he's saying, I know that this is going to be a big sacrifice for you.
So I'm emphasizing the enormity of the sacrifice and putting the screws on you.
But it also excludes Ishmael.
It does exclude it. But he could have said Isaac and it wouldn't have excluded Ishmael anyway. You know, I just had to call him by his name. It would be fairly clear whom he meant.
Yes.
But that's not the end of the horror. You're asking a man to commit an act which is beyond imagination, and you do it flippantly. Offer him up on one of the places which I will tell you. What's that kind of instruction? So it means he's got to kriach out for 3 days. You'll see one hilltop, maybe it's there. See another hilltop, maybe it's there. The poor man's put on the rack. He never knows when the bolt will strike him. Had you not noticed that before? I told you this is quite a story.
Yeah. But it doesn't actually say what he's to do.
It does. It says offer him up as a sacrifice. Because that language is absolutely clear. Ha'alehu sham le'ola, offer him up as a sacrifice. And ola is a burnt offering. No, the rabbis will try and curve out and say, no, all he said was take him up and bring him down. That is a kvetch. That's playing with words. To offer up is to sacrifice, and there ain't no two ways about it.
But isn't the whole thing a test?
Of course it's a test. The whole thing is a test. And of course, does Abraham know that he doesn't have to do it? Clearly,
it wouldn't be a test.
So for Abraham,
he always tests the most righteous.
Yeah, but my point was this: Abraham's faith had been tested time and time and time again, 9 times up till here. So what do you want the minion for? What point are you making? By demanding of him the unthinkable, demanding of him the unacceptable. He should have said no. Could have said no. After all, you promised Isaac would be the ancestor of my progeny. You're breaking your word. I don't accept it.
But then his faith would be such that if he believed that he would know that it was going to have a happy ending.
Well, that's it.
It would be like Yoshua, you know, like
Resurrection. Yeah. Oh, that's a nice thought. Oh, I never thought of that one. Well, maybe. You won't laugh by the time I finish with you, I promise you. I'm keeping.
It has an echo of the first command.
Pardon?
Lech lecha.
Yes.
Has an echo of.
Sure. Mm-hmm. You got going once, now get going again.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, Vayashkem Avram Baboker. Abraham gets up early in the morning. What significance are we to attach to that? I could prosaically say, if you live in the south of Israel, you will know that you don't go on sightseeing at lunchtime. Yeah. Certainly not in the summer. When do you go?
Early
in the morning. So this may be pragmatic. I'm going out. Let's go out before the sun cooks me. But it is possible that this is body language. That he's getting up early to show his willingness. And that's borne out by what comes next. By Yachavoshet Hamoro, and he saddles his donkey. Abraham had 318 strong-armed men. So he has to saddle his own donkey? He's 100 plus. According to the rabbis, 137. Bli Ayin Ra. So he's got to saddle his own donkey? Unless he insists, no, I'm doing it. And why am I doing it? To show I'm doing it. Vayikach et shneini arav ito, and he takes his two men with him. Va'et Yitzchak beno, and Isaac his son. Look what comes there. Vayivaka atzeola, and he chops the wood for the burnt offering. What about the 318 guys? So he's got to do the chopping up.
Well, they're still asleep. It's early in the morning.
They're too early in the morning. Well, I could say one thing. You know, I could justify it by saying this was all part of the sacrificial ritual. Mm-hmm. And since he is performing the sacrifice, go chop thou thine own wood.
Yeah. Was that normal?
But I don't know. I'm just making that as a proposition.
Makes sense, doesn't it?
But at the same time, it could be body language.
To know what he was going to do.
No, certainly not. I mean, he's not. But if I'm going to offer up a sacrifice, yes. I mean, they don't know what he's going to do. He says to his people, we're going to sacrifice to the Lord. Doesn't say who. Mm-hmm. So, okay, we're going to sacrifice. He did it already before. It wasn't the first time. All he conceals is the actual sacrifice. But chopping the wood and all these things, either they are ritualistic, or this is his way of saying to God, you've asked it, I'm doing it. I'm not holding back.
But only when they get there, they realise that they're...
Well, wait and see. Hmm? Wait and see. You know, we've only just started the drama. You want the popcorn already. Wait.
What does it mean by Kach Yitzchak Beno?
He took him. Doesn't mean he grabbed him and took him, no.
How old was he? I mean, he was...
Oh, thank you. That's another 64,000.
He was a baby.
Don't know. Well, don't know. According to the rabbis,
yeah.
He is, in fact... 37.
There we are.
37. Yeah. We'll come to it. Be patient. Be patient. Well, a little bit patient. And so, Vayakom, he rose up, Vayelech lemakom asher Elohim, and he goes to the region which God had told him. Vayom hashlishi, on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes, and he saw the place from a distance. Now, just a cotton picking minute. He hasn't been told where the place was. It would be on one of the mountains. Now he can see the mountain.
And this is why he left early in the morning.
Yeah. Well, he's been travelling for 3 days.
Exactly.
So there's what we call a hiatus in the text. Clearly, at some point, God must have told him the mountain, and now he's gone to it. The rabbis will say no. He saw a nimbus of cloud around the top of a mountain. You don't see that often in Eretz Yisrael, so that must be the place. Okay, that's the Midrashic solution. What comes next? And Abraham says to his young men, you stay here with the donkey. The two-legged donkeys can stay with the four-legged one. V'ani v'hanar, whilst I and the boy, Nelechad Ko, will go to that point up there, v'nishtachaveh, and we shall bow down, v'nashuva aleichem, and we will return to you. That isn't true.
Presumably Isaac was married at the age of 37. Yeah. Isaac would have been married.
No, he wasn't. He'd get married till 3 years after. It took him 3 years to get over the shock, and then he got married.
And they keep calling him a now.
Yes, now, sure.
Well, yes, because he's not.
He's a bachor, you see. My synagogue at the age of 18 is still calling him a bachor. What do you want? Yeah, he's not married yet. We'll discuss his age in a moment, but this will come up. But what is incorrect is he says, we will return. Abraham knows we are not going to return. I am going to return. So quite clearly he's saying this for two reasons. Number one, he doesn't want to let on to Isaac what's happening. Because if you say, I'll come back, so Isaac will say, well, where am I going? Number two, he doesn't want to let the young men know what's going on. That's why he says, you stay here. Because if he take them up the mountain, and they'll see him tying up his son, he's going to kill him. They'll say, the old guy has flipped his lid. They'll restrain him.
Could it be that when this was written down, in retrospect, this is how they worded it?
No, I think we
you know, because there are a lot of things that just don't add up.
Well, we're going to see this the whole point. We have to look at what's going on here, look at the things that don't add up, and see if we can make them add up. Eventually, we hope. And so, Vayikach Avraham et Atzeh Olah, Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering, Vayasim al Yitzchak Beno, and he put it on Isaac his son. That is very poignant. Because what does Abraham know? Isaac is going to end up on the wood. And still he's taking that wood and he's putting it on the boy. Body language. He's saying to God, I'm doing it. I may not want to do it. I may be horrified by it. But you have asked me, and I'm doing it.
And Yitzchak submits without...
What do you mean? He doesn't know what's going on.
Well, he must have realized.
No, not yet.
What, 37?
Well, he doesn't know. Well, let's see.
Well, it was an inconceivable his father didn't sacrifice other people. Yeah. So why would you suddenly start on him?
I think that is the answer I would have given. There's no reason to suspect that he's for the chop, but be a little patient. And he took et ha'ish, v'yikach v'yado et ha'ish, he took in his hands the fire. You can't go up the top of the mountain and rub two Boy Scouts together. You bring your fire with you. Ve'et ha'ma'achelet, and the knife. And of course we translate it as the knife. But that is not an accurate or adequate translation, because there are other words for knife in Hebrew. This is the knife. It's ha'ma'achelet. And quite clearly it's to do with the word achal, to eat. This is a knife that was essential for making food fit to be eaten. And in Jewish law, what makes food fit to be eaten? Yes, it has the shechita. That renders it edible. This is his ritual slaughtering knife. Right? It's something special to perform
what
a sacrifice.
What is the other word for knife?
Sakin.
Oh, sakin.
They use word cherev.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, there are other words.
And is this word used now for a slaughtering knife?
No. They use another word. But it occurs again in a most horrendous story that I think we read, with the Pelegish Begiva, that terrible story of the Levite that cuts up his concubine. And he used his ma'achelet, his sacrificial knife. He was a nice guy. V'yelechu shneim yachdav, the two of them go on together. Vayomer Yitzchak el Avraham Aviv. Now Isaac says to Abraham his father, Vayomer, he says, Abi, Daddy. Vayomer, he says, Hineni b'ni, I'm here, my son. Once again, very poignant. I don't lose sight of the fact you're my son. Vayomer, he says, Hinei ha'esh v'ha'itzim. Here is the fire. Here is the wood. Va'ayeh ha'sel ola. Where is the lamb for the burnt offering? So does he know? Has he any idea what's going on? To ask so obvious a question. In fact, if you say he was 37 years old, not very bright, is he? Because they've been travelling for 3 days, and now he suddenly realises there is no lamb for a burnt offering. More to the story than meets the eye. I mean, why do I assume he's 37? Let's get that one out of the way. Well, it's quite simple, actually. It's a bit of rabbinic logic, which you'll appreciate enormously. Sarah was 90 when Isaac was born. And immediately after the story of the Arkadah, we're told she died. And the rabbi said, you know why she died? Because Abraham came home with Isaac, and Isaac said, you never know what Daddy did to me. And when he tells her, she drops dead. So, if she, how old was she when she died? 127.
Okay.
So, Isaac is 37 years old.
I thought that the bad angel had come and told...
No, yes, there is another tradition. There are various traditions.
He was already dead.
He was already dead. Yeah, there are various things that... shall we say, precipitate her death. She suffers from a cardiac arrest. Okay? What is the truth of the matter? Looking at the story as it stands, for a 37-year-old man not to realize there is no lamb stretches the imagination. But if it was a child who maybe was going out for the first time on so long a journey with his father, to perform a sacrificial act. So he's all excited and taking in the terrain. The last thing he's noticed is what? There's no land. Only when the two of them are now going up the hill together, he suddenly realizes, just a moment, there's me and him, and there's no land. And this is Ibn Ezra's view. Ibn Ezra says he's probably 12, 13 years old.
It would make much more sense. Like that.
Old enough to carry the wood, but young enough to be overpowered by his father and tied down and trussed up like a chicken. Bear that in mind. Bear that in mind. If he was 37 years old, so how did he know? His daddy must have been a master of kung fu.
But
unless, of course, the rabbis are going to assume he collaborated. But let's leave that for the moment, shall we? Don't anticipate too much. I've got to upset you still. How does Daddy reply? And Abraham said, God will select for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And the two of them went on together. Has he told him anything?
No.
Nope. Isaac is still in the dark.
That's how you punctuate it.
Yeah.
If you punctuate it,
well, no, no, how can I say? How should I take it that way? Hine? Ah, if I say it. Hashem Yirelo Haseh Leola B'ni, oh my son, I take it as evocative. If you know what I mean. Yeah. You, you might say,
oh.
No, that's...
You were taking it as accusative.
Yeah. No, 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 no. You want to suggest that he's telling him you are the sacrificial animal. I'm not sure that's the plain meaning of the text.
No, not the plain meaning, of course.
Well, maybe the Midrash play games like that. You have to wait and see. You'd be amazed what games the Midrash will play. But we would have to agree, according to the plain meaning of the text, at this stage, Isaac is none the wiser, but not for long. For Yavoh el ha-makom asher amar lo Elohim, and they got to the place where God had told him of. Vayiven sham Abraham et ha-mizbeach, and Abraham built there the altar. Vayaroch et ha-itzim, and he arranged the wood in whatever ceremonial or sacrificial manner. Vayakod et Yitzchak beno, and he tied up Isaac his son. Why did he tie him up? Because if he hadn't tied him up, says Ibn Ezra, he'd have run for his life. Tie me kangaroo down. He had to tie him up.
One wonders how such an old man can tie up a man of
37. That's it. That's why Ibn Ezra said he had to be no more than 12 or 13. But there is an alternative, and we have to wait and see. You can understand Ibn Ezra's logic. His logic, it fits him much better with the plain meaning of the text. Vayasim otal ha-mizbeach me'al ha-itzim, and he puts him on the altar above the wood. Isaac was carrying the wood, now the wood is carrying Isaac. Vayishlach Avraham et yado, and Abraham sends forth his hand. And look now, the whole motion of the picture has slowed down. 3 days went in a flash. Now it's zoom in, slow down. He sends forth his hand. Vayikach et hamar achelet, and he takes the knife. Lishchot et bano, to slaughter his son. Vayikrai la malach Adonai min hashamayim, and an angel of the Lord cries out from heaven, and vayomer, and he says, Avraham, Avraham! Why is he saying his name twice? He's agitated. The angel is agitated to stop him. What's Abraham's response? The same composed response he gave when God first spoke to him. What does it tell me about this man's state of mind?
He's relaxed.
He's totally composed and intent upon what he has to do. And the angel says, do not send forth your hand against the boy. Don't do anything to him. For now I know that you are a God-fearing man. Thank you, you didn't know that up till now. Et bincha et yechidecha mimeni. because you did not withhold your son, your only one, from me. A word is missing. When he first asks him to take Isaac, he says, Asher Ahavta, whom you love. And this time he doesn't say that.
Who's talking here?
This is God speaking through the angel. Malachim are only voice boxes for God.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, they are only voice. They are God's voice box. Vayisa Avraham, and Abraham lifted up his eyes. Vayar, and he saw v'hinei ayil, and there was a ram. Achar nechas basvach bekarnav, after it had been caught by its horns in a thicket. Abraham said, when I came up here, there was nothing here but me, Isaac. Suddenly there's a ram caught by its horns in a thicket. Quite clearly this is what? This is the hand of God. God has provided me with the sacrifice. I haven't come here for nothing. Vayelech Avram, so Abraham went, vayikach et ha'ayil, took the ram, vayalehu le'olah tachat bono, and he offered it up as a sacrifice in place of his son. Vayikra Avraham shem ha'makom ahu Adonai yireh, and Abraham called the name of that place, the Lord will see. What? I don't know. Asher ye'amer hayom, as is said till this day, v'har Adonai yireh, on the mountain of the Lord it may be seen. What? It's a very strange statement. God will see. Maybe it means from this time on God will see, i.e. he will have a visual image of what I was prepared to do for him. He will always see my act. And on this mountain it will be seen. Maybe. Remember that this mountain did have a destiny of its own. It was going to be the site of the temple. And so therefore there's a linkage between the temple and Abraham's act.
He said the rock that's inside...
According to the tradition, the rock there is supposed to be the rock upon which Abraham sacrificed Isaac.
They say Ishmael, don't they?
And they say Ishmael, it bears the imprint of the foot of Muhammad. According to rabbinic tradition, it is the foundation stone of the earth. It is the Evin Shtiya, the rock about which the earth coagulated. But according to another rabbinic source, it was a meteorite that fell there during the 8th century BCE. We'll leave that for another time. I think the last explanation is probably the most plausible. But the rock is still there.
Mm.
The rock is still there.
The navel of the world.
Tiburo shel olam.
Surely the difficulty is that the Quran story is different.
Oh, yes.
So you've got two different stories about an act. I personally used to have great difficulty when I took the children's services to deal with this problem, and I didn't deal with it at all, because I find it extremely difficult to believe. There is no way, however much faith I have, that I could sacrifice myself. There is no way. They could test me 9 times and the 10th time. And
no, you'd probably say, kill me, but leave him alone.
I beg your pardon?
You would probably say, kill me and let him live. Lord on high, you know, take my life.
Yeah.
So I agree.
From that point of view, I personally regard this as a story to tell, a moral.
In other words, it never happened. It's just an invented story with a message.
Well, this is what I think.
I'm afraid I'd have to disagree with you. Well, I treat this as historical reality. It did happen. And has and I told you it's a horrendous story, you know, I didn't hide that from you. It is a horrendous story, and the rabbis will struggle to find a meaning for it. Because it bristles with problems. God breaks his promise.
Yes.
He asks for that which he himself forbids, human sacrifice.
We shouldn't think of Abraham being of the same standard as ours.
Yeah.
He was in a different level.
Well, take that one stage further. This incident proves it.
Yeah.
That he reached the pinnacle of faith on Mount Moriah.
Yeah.
To coin a phrase. Good. I mean, that's one of the ways we have to look at this. The whole question is, but why did God do this to him? You know, why did he have to scale this particular mountain to prove his faith? That's a real issue. And I can't answer these questions yet. And maybe when I do answer them, you won't be satisfied. But that will be your prerogative. Okay, let's finish the story, at least a little more of it. The angel calls Abraham a second time from the heavens. By Yomin, he says, Binish Batini Umadunai. I swear by myself, says the Lord. If you want a guarantee for my pledge, it's me, and I'm around forever. Kiyana Shasita Tadabaze. Because you performed this act, this incredible, this unthinkable act. You did not withhold your son, your only one. I will therefore surely bless you. I will multiply your progeny like the stars of the heaven, like the sand on the seashore, and your progeny will inherit the gates of its enemy. They will conquer this land. But also with Baruchu Bazaracha, Kol Goyei Haaretz, through your progeny shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. Israel, the Jewish people, were intended to be a benefit for mankind, whether mankind appreciates it or not. It's part of our destiny. So, we may benefit them, we may be good to them, and eventually they will pick us up by the scruff of the neck and throw us out, but we have to fulfill our destiny. It's a thought, isn't it?
Sorry, but I'm still troubled by the fact that the missing Asher HaHavta.
Yeah. I think you should be troubled by it. I'll give you a very simple answer. Because at that moment, Abraham proved he loved God more than he loved Isaac.
Say that again?
Because at that moment, Abraham proved that as much as he loved Isaac, he loved God even more.
He believed because God promised.
Yeah, but
he said that I will make you a great nation.
Sure.
And give you a son.
So, it could have been somebody else. That was the nub of the test. I made you a promise, I'm now breaking my promise. And now, having performed his act, God is reaffirming his promise. But I want you to bear that thought in mind. Maybe he has shown he loves God even more. Okay, yep. Be patient. We'll get to it around about week 3. Yeah, I'm setting you up for things. That's the whole point of the exercise. You know, that's what we're doing.
There is a sort of excuse me.
Yeah.
There is a sort of an, I don't know how to call it, an asterisk.
Yeah.
Under the
Shema.
Vayakmu.
Oh, Vayakumu.
Vayakumu,
no. That is an asterisk after the word Vayashava, showing that this is where the Maftia begins.
Okay.
It's a printer's note. But look at that last verse and spot the deliberate mistake. Vayashava Avraham el Ne'arav, and so Abraham returned to his young men. Vayakumu, and they arose. Vayeluchu Yachdav Beersheba, they returned together to Beersheba. Vayeshav Avraham Beersheba. Where's Isaac gone? It should have said Vayashuvu, returned,
yeah.
Instead of Vayashov, and Abraham returned. Oh dear. Now that's a problem.
Maybe Isaac is recovering from the shock.
Yeah, he's carrying him on his back, over the back of the donkey. The rabbis will make use of this. That's all I'm going to say.
But right. He really did sacrifice.
I'm not going. Why should I give the game away? You won't come back and watch the next instalment. Right, now, having looked at this text, let's turn our attention to the Midrash.
You want these back?
Yes, I'll take them back.
No.
Well, whenever you wish it. I need one, but pass the rest around. There should be enough. I did 25, but Bli Ayin Ra, we do have quite a number here this evening. Yeah, I'm very pleased. Oh, there was another one to go. I kept one for me. How are we doing for numbers? Yeah, there should.
There's
still two more. We need them.
Yes, there's still. We've still got enough. We're looking at a text that I've taken from one of the oldest Midrashim, Bereshit Rabbah. It's the commentary, Midrashic commentary to the book of Genesis. It was compiled in the land of Israel in the 6th century. But the material it contains goes back a long way before the 6th century. 6th century is significant because it means it was compiled before the Arab invasion. And therefore the language of administration at that time was still Greek. And you will find in the Midrash and the Jerusalem Talmud thousands of Greek words. It's a characteristic of these early Midrashim. So it's a commentary. But our author does something rather unusual. He begins every chapter of his commentary with some little sermons. And they were actual living sermons delivered to living audiences, and they follow a regular pattern. The preacher will begin his little sermon by taking a verse, not from the Torah, but from the third section of the Hebrew Bible, from Psalms, from Proverbs, from Job, from Ecclesiastes, and then proceed to interrelate that verse with the morning's reading. For you it's the parasha, for him it was the sidra, because in the land of Israel they called it a sidra. Now, why was he doing this? Well, if you think about it, we do have an omission on our Shabbat morning and Yom Tov morning readings. We read from the law, we read from the prophets. What about the holy writings? They're left out. Why? They're not there. To compensate for this, the rabbi introduces a verse from the holy writings to show the inseparability of all three. But he had an additional agenda. Remember that the church, and we've discussed this before, Christianity regarded the Bible, the Torah, as having been abrogated. Jesus had done away with the law. And for us, only the prophets and the holy writings have significance. And the rabbis demonstrated that if you invalidate any one section of these holy writings, you invalidate all three, because they are inseparable. The phrase that my revered teacher used many years ago may be familiar to you, for those of you who know Hebrew, Chut HaMushulash Shelo B'Mehira Yinatek, which are three ply cord that cannot easily be broken. Now, when were these little sermons given? But before I say that, you were...
I haven't quite taken...
Well, challenge me, I don't mind.
No, I haven't understood, can't say. So what we're saying, the Christians took out...
Oh, the Christians declared that the law was no longer effective, only for the horrible Jews.
Is that the Torah?
The Torah was now relegated, along with the Jewish people, to the sidelines. For us, it's no longer, has no validity. And therefore, they emphasize the remaining two. And the rabbi stepped in and said, you can't have the best of three, it's three or nothing. Yeah.
But in the actual service in the synagogue, there are readings from the Psalms.
Well, we have it in our prayers.
Yes.
Certainly. But it's But there is no formal reading with a blessing. I don't read from the Torah, and then from the prophets, and then from the Psalms. That isn't done. Did they ever have such a reading is a subject for much discussion, but little certainty.
So they had Chumash, they had Haftarah. It's only the Ketubim that didn't have.
Well, they had the Ketubim. If you'd have gone in, let me explain. If you'd have walked into an ancient synagogue in the land of Israel in Talmudic times, there would be the Heichal. And in the Heichal, lying flat, not standing up, you would have a whole series of scrolls. You would have the scrolls of the Torah, the scrolls of the prophets, and the scrolls of the holy writings. All the official books of the Bible were on display. Because if they were not official, they were hidden away. And the Hebrew word for hidden is genuz, and the Greek word for it is apocrypha. They were hidden, not available to the general public. So they had the they had the book of Psalms, they had the book of Proverbs, but they weren't reading from it on a Shabbat morning.
Right.
That's the point. So when were these sermons given? It seems most likely that before the reading of the law, the rabbi got up and delivered this little sermon to focus the attention of his audience on an issue that was going to arise from the verses that followed. This was an hors d'oeuvre. And the Hebrew name for it is Paticha, the opener. Mm-hmm. The opener. So let's have a look now at our first little sermon. We should have enough time to do one, maybe we'll do two. Like to do two, because I want to send you away with something to disturb you. It came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham. And there is the first problem. God tested Abraham? The all-seeing, the all-knowing God tests? Can't mean that. And so our preacher quotes his verse from the Psalms. Natata lireecha neis lehitnos, says, you have given those who fear you a nace in order to be displayed. Now the word nace, of course, in this context means a banner. But of course nace is very like the word nisa, to test. So he says, no, it's not a banner. It's nisayon acha nisayon. You confer one test after another upon those who fear you, to result in gidalon acha gidalon, resulting in ever increasing aggrandizement. As they pass each test, they go up the ladder of spiritual greatness. And why are you doing this? Because you don't know what they're like? No. Bishvil nasotam ba'olam, in order to elevate them in the world. Bishvil legadlam ba'olam, in order to raise them up high in the world. Kaneshel svina, like the flag on a ship's mast.
Wow.
But why are you doing this, Lord? Why are you so anxious to display Abraham like a ship and a flag on a ship's mast? Bipnei koshet sela, out of consideration for the truth, says the psalm. And what does that mean? Bishvil shetit kashet midat hadin ba'olam, so that your justice may be verified in the world. Shim yom alecha adam, so if someone will come along and say to you, your God is vicarious, lemishu rotzeh ma'ashir, if he wants to make somebody rich, he'll do it. Nothing to do with personal merit. Lemishu rotzeh ma'ani, if he wants to make somebody poor, he'll make them poor. If whom he wants, he'll make a king, regardless of their lack or presence of any virtue. Abraham, and in the case of Abraham, who was a nobody, when it suited him, he made him rich. When he wanted to, he made him a king. Abraham was a king. Yachol atla hashivo. If somebody says that to you, you can now say to him and say, Loman, answer him. Yachol at la'asot ma she'asa Abraham? Can you do what Abraham did? Abraham was 100 years old when Isaac his son was born to him. After all the aggro of waiting till he was 100 years old to have a son, God said to him, take your son, the lo ikev, and he didn't hold back. Could you do that? That's what it means. God imposed a test on Abraham to display him like a flag. Hence it says, Elohim decided Abraham, God tested Abraham. God didn't test him to find out anything. God knew full well his qualities. He wanted to display those qualities to the rest of mankind so that they should not challenge God and say, why did you pick him? That sounds strange, doesn't it? So let me put it in its historical context. In those days, there was a sectarian group, a group of heretics, who believed in two gods. I've mentioned them before, the Gnostics. Mm-hmm. They believed in a perfect God, an all-knowing God. And they believed in a secondary deity who is the creator, an imperfect God, the God of the Jews. Not only is he imperfect as a creator, his justice is faulty. He is a deity of vicarious actions. And you can tell this by the people he chose. You can tell a man who boozes by the company he chooses. He chose Moses, who was a murderer. He chose David, a murderer and adulterer. He chose Abraham, who was a nobody. And the rabbis come back and say, what the heck are you talking about? God proved that Abraham was more than a somebody. He gave him a test to display those special qualities which puts him and me above criticism. Get the point? So he's explained away the testing. It's not testing, it's demonstrating. Does that make you feel happy? Not necessarily. Pardon?
It's very clever.
Clever? Oh, you bet. Listen, they weren't rabbis for nothing. They're not like today. But look at the second one. Second sermon. This one begins with a strident verse. Adonai tzadik yivchan. The Lord tries the righteous. V'rasha ve'ohev chamas sanah nafsho. Whereas the wicked person and the lover of violence, his whole soul hates.
Yes, pardon?
His soul hates those. In other words, the verse says, if you're not a decent person, God doesn't bother with you. So if he is trying you, you know you're a righteous person. He's bothering with you. God only deals with those who matter to him. So already my verse is indicating that trial has a deeper meaning. God cares about me. But look how he continues. The rabbis were speaking to ordinary folk, peasants, farmers. They weren't sophisticated. You couldn't talk to them in philosophical language. So you took basic illustrations from the marketplace. And he says, Amar Rabbi Yonatan, Rabbi Yonatan said, go out into the marketplace. You've got the potter there. He makes his vessels and he sells his vessels. And how does he attract the attention of the audience? He bangs them. When I was a kid, I used to go down Petticoat Lane. The guy sitting in the crockery, banging them together. You see, look, fantastic stuff. Of course, it may well be he had those specially made, whereas the rest of it was rubbish. And look what he says. Hayotza Azeh, this potter, he made the vessels. Eino bode kankanim groim. He doesn't bash the faulty ones. Where he knows he couldn't tap them even once without breaking them. That won't bring in the customers. Mabodek, so what does he test? Kankanim berurim, only the strong vessels. Sha'afiluhu makishalehen kama, even if he bashes them many times, Eino shovram, he won't break them. Kach eina kadosh baruch hu menaseh et harashayim. So it is that God doesn't test the wicked, Elah tzadikim, only the righteous. As it says, Adonai tzadik yivchan, the Lord tries the righteous. So why is God trying Abraham? Because that is his strong vessel. Abraham advertises God. When mankind will see what I have chosen, then they will realize the perfection. I tested Abraham in order to demonstrate the superlative quality of my work. God only uses the best to demonstrate himself. Abraham was the best. That's one explanation. The next guy says, no, go out into the marketplace and take a look at the flax merchant. Now, a flax merchant would be sitting there with all his flax pile. This would be the original green plant. Flax is a plant. And it's a very oily plant when it's fresh. Ha-pishtani azeh. This flax merchant, b'shar sheyodea sha-pishtan shelo yafeh, when he knows that his flax is of perfect quality, it's fresh, it's the best. Kol shehu kotcha, he mishtabachad u'mishtamenet. The more he beats it, so the more it glistens, the more its oil rises to the surface, and people will know this is first-class product. He's bringing out the best in his product. Whereas u'v'shar shehi ra'ah, when it is second class, Einu maspik lahakish aleha achat ad shenipkad. He couldn't bash it once without it splitting open, and everybody would see its rotten produce. Kachena kadosh baruch hu manaseh et harashayim elat hatzadikim. So God tries the righteous, not the wicked. What's he implying? When the flax merchant beats the flax, he's bringing the best out of it. When God beats the righteous man, he's bringing the best out in him.
So similar explanation to the first
one. Similar. Whereas the first one is to demonstrate my qualities, the second one says, I do this to a good man to bring out the best in him. When God tries a righteous man, it's for his benefit. Trial is for your benefit. When God did that to Abraham, he was bringing the best out in the man. How do you like that one? Are these things clear? I don't want to rush in.